You know, it's my great pleasure right now to introduce to everybody a man who really needs no introduction.
Carl.
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 Carl. Dragon.
King.
Carl. I'm not calling the fans geeks. I'm not calling them rednecks, tobacco chewing nothing, because I've done all that myself.
Carl.
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 Carl. Dragon.
King. Carl.
In your dreams, you will see me.
Excuse me, please, let's don't talk negatively.
I'm going to win the title. I'm going to keep my money and buy me some good old Tennessee drinking whiskey with it.
Thank you for being such a great husband.
And this is for you, Fannie Mae. Solid gold, baby, just like you and me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to When It Was Cool Wrestling, the Dragon King Carl Classic Wrestling audio show. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for supporting us at figure4online.com, wrestlingobserver.com, and my website, whenitwascool.com. Hope you will continue to do so and check out all the podcasts we have to offer. In our rotation of classic wrestling shows, we're back around to From the Pages of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. And this is where I go through old obituaries, biographies, Hall of Fame pieces, history pieces that Dave Meltzer has written in the pages of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. And I've gone through and dug all these up for you. I'm going through them in chronological order. And we are up to September the 22nd of 2008, where Dave has done the obituary biography of Killer Kowalski. And this is a very in-depth biography, and so let's get right into it. September 22nd, 2008. At Walter Kowalski's funeral on September the 3rd, 2008, it looked more like a reunion of New England independent wrestlers of the last 30 years. Some looked like wrestlers, and some by that point looked like anything but. The vast majority never really went anywhere past the independent scene, although there were some notable exceptions. One of the pallbearers, Paul Levesque, better known as Triple H, married into the McMahon family and is one of the biggest modern stars in pro wrestling. Evidently, Kowalski expected Levesque to make it from the start. Levesque, a former Mr. Teenage New Hampshire, had met one of Kowalski's students, Tony Roy, at that point one of his best wrestlers on the local shows, while training at the gym. Levesque had the size and the look, and in his first match, Terra Rising, the name he was given, came out to the ring wearing one of Kowalski's robes, something he had never done for any protege. The people reminisced about stories of long car trips to small towns for benefit shows and of their mentor's generosity, even when he shouldn't have been so nice. They talked about how he taught them wrestling and tried to give them lessons on life and how he ran the dressing room, how he always got up at 5 a.m. to pray and his unique eating habits. There were the road stories he'd tell over and over again, like the Yukon Eric Ear story or the Haystacks Calhoun story on a memorable flight to Japan, or when he knocked out Antonio Inoki in Osaka and then had to figure out a way for Inoki to beat him. A lot of the talk was about another of his proteges who made it, Perry Saturn, who nobody had seen or heard from in more than a year. When Saturn didn't surface for his mentor's death or funeral, everyone was asking questions as to where he was, or if he was even still alive. What wasn't talked about much at all, because it was before the time of most of the people there, is that Killer Kowalski was known for most of his professional life, was one of the biggest stars and most enduring headliners in wrestling history. Burt Ray, who wrote Matt Mania, something of the inside Bible of pro wrestling during the 1960s, wrote in early 1996, quote, "Who is the top wrestler in the world today? Who is the best of the past 15 or 20 years? There will be many opinions on these questions, but few will argue if any person names Killer Kowalski as the best of that period." When you consider that names who headlined the era like Luthez, Buddy Rogers, Ricky Dozan, Vern Gagne, Bruno Sammartino, Pat O'Connor, and others, that's some pretty major company to be listed on or ahead of. As Tarzan Kowalski, he was the Hulk Hogan of his era. He was an instant headliner, and once on December 11, 1950 in Fort Worth, he became a one-man Texas Tag Team Champion after he beat the champions Duke Kiyomuka and Danny Savage in a handicap match at the time when booking like that was a rarity. I first saw Killer Kowalski in San Francisco in early 1951, wrote Ray. He was a huge person with an almost perfect physique, wide of chest, narrow of hip, with dark green eyes and fair complexion of his Southern European birthright. As with any top heel working Northern California in the 1950s, his big rival was the local football hero, Leo Nomolini, of the San Francisco 49ers, who wrestled during the offseason. For those of you who have never seen Leo, think of a man with the skill of Vern Gagne or Lou Thesz, the massive power of a Cowboy Bill Watts, the boyish good looks of Jack Briscoe, or the short blonde hair of a Bob Orton Sr., and you have the idea of Leo. My early days in wrestling were centered around the Kowalski and Nomolini feud, and I still remember well the right of Kowalski and tag team partner, large German headliner Hans Hermann, diving for the floor when Leo launched one of his body tackles in their direction. And that should have been well remembered the night. I will point out that this obituary by Dave, more than a lot, has a lot of typographical errors in there, so bear with me. Apparently it didn't get got in at deadline and probably didn't get edited or something. Nick Botwinkle, who is going to high school a stone's throw from the Cow Palace in South San Francisco, as his father Warren Botwinkle was a babyface on Joe Malkiewicz's Northern California circuit, first remembered Kowalski from 1949. "I saw Walter Kowalski enter the ring in a long purple robe," Botwinkle told the Malden Observer. "And when he took it off, he turned to the audience, he lifted up his arms and roared. It was the most magnificent sight I'd ever seen." Keep in mind that in those days, when major sports athletes were told not to lift weights, you didn't see pro athletes of that size. Wrestling had Sky High Lee, who was taller, but he wasn't very athletic. Don Leo Jonathan, arguably the most agile big man ever, came a few years later. A guy Kowalski's size could have played center in the NBA, and the biggest lineman in the NFL, Eugene Big Daddy Lipscomb, who later became one of his pro wrestling rivals, was about the same size. But that version of Kowalski was long gone on February 22, 1960, the night Kowalski first wrestled his most famous rival, Bruno Sammartino, in Madison Square Garden, replacing a slimmer but better conditioned version of himself. It was still the era of Argentina Roca, so Kowalski versus Sammartino, going to a no contest in 16 minutes 38 seconds, was second from the top underneath a Roca and Miguel Perez win over the Fabulous Fargos, going under the names Wildman Jackie Fargo and Wildman Don Stevens, before a near sellout of 18,896 fans. There was actually an advertised Sammartino versus Kowalski match at Madison Square Garden on January 2, 1960, but Bull Curry subbed for Kowalski underneath a sellout drawn by Rocca versus Amazing Zuma. "I loved wrestling the man," said Sammartino, who noted that while he doesn't know for sure because there are no such things as complete records, he figured that he may have wrestled Kowalski more times than any other opponent during his career. "He kept such a fast pace, so wrestling him, I felt great. I felt my heart, if I could endure 60 minutes with Walter, there wasn't anybody I couldn't go with." While Sammartino had great respect for how Kowalski lived his life, training harder and eating right, the two virtually never socialized until after Kowalski had retired, because that's how both were taught in the business. But this was the second version of Kowalski, the man who turned against the T-bone steaks and barbell plates that made him such a big attraction in the first incarnation of his career. There are a number of things that happened that may have played a part in it. One was that Roger Bannister ran the first four-minute mile on May 6, 1954. Kowalski found out that Bannister was a vegetarian. "That really impressed me," Kowalski said. "From that time on, nothing that walked, crawled, swam, flew, or slithered have I eaten." He claimed he only lapsed twice. The first time was 6 weeks after, due to a loss of willpower. The other was during the 1960s, when a chef at a diner who was a big fan made him an elaborate meal with bacon and ham when he ordered a mushroom omelet, and rather than offend him, he ate it. It was a labor of love, Kowalski said about the chef who made the meal, so I put it in my mouth and I clapped my hands. I hollered, "Fantastic!" And boy, was he pleased. He bowed, the waitress beamed. For me to refuse that would have been worse than the little harm that the meat did to me. There may have been other occasions. Kowalski was fond of all-you-can-eat buffets, looking for them while on the road, and it was his regular Sunday routine while at home. One person remarked to me that they were at a place and Kowalski didn't know what he had put on his plate, and that they told Kowalski that it was a meat dish. Kowalski thanked them for telling him, and he didn't eat it. He became intrigued and read up on the subject and believed that meat hurt your stamina. Up to that time, he had been an avid weightlifter, starting as a teenager to build himself up for high school swimming and getting so good at it that the wrestling people recruited him. But he believed lifting weights made you slow and stiff, and he stopped cold turkey, concentrating on endless push-ups, squats, and the old standby jumping jacks, an exercise which has gone out of favor. But the training must have worked, since Kowalski had the reputation as the best-conditioned big man in the industry, and was never a guy caught out of breath at a match, no matter how fast a pace he worked or how long the match went. There were those who were critical of his ring style, believing he sometimes worked too fast for people to react to everything that he did, while a lot of the babyfaces didn't enjoy working with him because it surely was not like a night off. He went through a very spiritual crisis in his life the next year, and at one point went on a religious fast for so long and lost so much weight that he almost died. I was afraid he was going to die, said Don Leo Jonathan, one of his closest friends in the business, in an interview with Slam Wrestling. He was down to around 150 pounds, just a skeleton. Hans Herrmann went over to see him, and he was laying on his couch, and he was living on juice, grapefruit juice or something like that. He was going to try and live on air. Somebody told him he could just do it, and he went to the limit. Man, I'm telling you, he looked like he just came out of a prison. He must have apparently decided to retire as a wrestler because on February the 4th, 1955, he did a world title versus career match with Lou Thesz that drew 14,000 fans in St. Louis. Since Sam Mushnick wasn't one for doing fake stipulations and Kowalski did leave wrestling 5 weeks later, there must have been a feeling that he was serious. At the time of his crisis, he held the world heavyweight title for Eddie Quinn's Montreal-based promotion. He gave Quinn his notice and on March 9th, 1955, dropped the title to Pat O'Connor in losing by DQ. He did a rematch a week later where O'Connor beat him and then he disappeared. He ended up joining a religious group called the Church of I Am, based in Denver, but was rejected in trying to become a priest. They said I asked too many questions, Kowalski told his friend Donnie Libel, but the church became the biggest thing in his life. And every year he'd donate 20% of his wrestling earnings, which ended up, besides his having a soft touch, as one of the reasons after decades of main events, he ended up in bad shape financially. In that religion, the color purple and a flame called the flame of violet represent the light of God in each person. Because of that, Kowalski usually wore purple trunks or would have trunks with violet lightning bolts. He claimed dropping meat improved his stamina and even credited it with improved mental focus. One thing I noticed was clear thinking, he said. The meat put something in the brain that retards mental development. I noticed I became more spiritual. But whether it was religion or his health fanaticism, some of it worked against him later. He would have been someone I greatly respected and would have gotten along with, said Bruno Sammartino. But in those days, we had kayfabed and could never be seen together. People would make stuff up anyway, like they saw me socializing with somebody I was wrestling, but it never happened. He didn't smoke, I didn't smoke, I never took a pain pill or an aspirin, neither did he, and he didn't drink or eat red meat. I did eat red meat and may have had a glass of wine with dinner and a few beers after a match. But one difference, Bruno Sammartino noted, is Killer Kowalski didn't believe in modern medicine. Believing, like red meat, it was poison. With all of his ring injuries during his career, he refused to ever see a doctor. It led to painful arthritis as he got older due to all of his untreated ring injuries. In recent years, the once towering man had shrunk greatly. "The last time I saw him, I went to Boston. I really wish I hadn't," said Sammartino. They used to say he was 6'6" or 6'7", and I think that was pretty legitimate. Kowalski, in an interview with me, being Dave DeMeltzer in the 80s, said that he was legitimately 6'6 during his career, but had shrunk at that point to 6'5". "I was measured by the State Athletic Commission doctors when I wrestled," this again is Bruno speaking, "and I was 6 foot, but now I'm a shade under 5'11". "When I saw him, I was taller than he was, and it bothered me for days. I talked to Dominique DiNucci and told him." LaBelle remembered when Big John Studd, who Kowalski trained in the early 1970s and considered like a son, was working a show for him while battling cancer, and he had all of his medicine on him. Kowalski blamed the steroids John Studd took for getting the cancer, which shortly thereafter took his life, but was just as mad about the medicine he was being prescribed to battle the cancer. "Poison," Walter would say, "it's all poison." Kowalski, citing health reasons, also refused to blade, which was a rarity among headliners of his era, although he was not alone, as others like Lou Thesz and Jack Briscoe had the same philosophy at the time. Thesz felt more that it was a cheap gimmick and that a real pro didn't need to get the crowd to respond. Kowalski wouldn't allow anyone to use the blade on shows he promoted years later. The second stage of Kowalski's wrestling career started when he returned to the ring in December of 1955 for good, and they wouldn't let him into the priesthood. To show how much Quinn must have thought of him, he was only back for 1 week when he defeated Don Leo Jonathan to regain the title, and he was also back in St. Louis by January. That started the era of the increasingly lean, sinewy Kowalski, who worked at a faster pace than most of the heavyweights, and in particular had a sudden high drop kick that was made more impressive because a man of that size was doing it. He was still very physically impressive, but not as much by today's steroid standards, but even without weights and meat, he was a big, fit guy who into his early 60s physically resembled a modern-day large NFL tight end. He no longer had the big wide shoulders, but he had the look of a well-conditioned large athlete. It wasn't until his early 40s that the body started looking less impressive, and probably started his career on a downward slide, although at no point was he considered anything less than a main eventer or a major star. While well-respected by most of the top wrestlers, a lot of babyfaces didn't like working with him. If you were in good shape, he'd work so fast he'd blow you up. If you were too tired for a comeback, he wouldn't respect you enough to give you much of one. When he came back, he worked mostly major cities. New York, St. Louis, Montreal, Boston, and Toronto were his favorites, and doing some dates in between in smaller cities near major markets. He owned his own small airplane and had a pilot's license, allowing him to travel more extensively while still remaining largely a loner. He worked mostly on top with the biggest names in the business in 1956 and 1957. O'Connor, his most frequent opponent in the United States, NWA champion Thesz, Montreal legend Yvonne Robert, Rogers, who could be the heel when the country's top two heels would square off, Wilbur Snyder, Rocca, Canada's most popular wrestler, Whipper Billy Watson, Bobby Manigault, acrobatic Eduardo Carpentier, fellow giant Don Leo Jonathan, early NFL legend Bronco Nagurski, Gene Kaniski, and Vern Gagne. On July 17, 1957, when he beat Kaniski to win the Montreal World title for the 8th time by countout, the show was held outdoors at a baseball stadium and drew 21,851 fans. Montreal, his career favorite city, was also the site of the match that made Killer Kowalski. He faced Yukon Eric. The two had wrestled several times before around North America, and it was a natural matchup. Kowalski as a huge heel and Eric as a 280-pound babyface with the gimmick of being the strongest man in the world. The matches were hardly classics, as Eric was very limited in what he could do, but the powerful lumberjack gimmick and the strongman spots made him a draw. They first crossed paths in 1949 and headlined in Montreal for an early 1950 match. They had wrestled each other a few more times in Canada, as well as Boston, before their famous match. It was October 15, 1952, at the Montreal Forum. Kowalski's version of the story is that he tied Eric's legs up in the ropes and prepared to give him a knee drop off the top rope to the chest. Eric rolled out of the way, but Kowalski shin boned Eric's heavily cauliflowered ear and sliced it off. Blood was squirting out his ear. There are reports that there was so much blood squirting out it was getting on ringsiders. Kowalski said a towel was quickly brought out and put over Eric's ear, and then it was drenched red in seconds. In Kowalski's version of the story, 2 days later, when he went to the promotion's offices at the Forum to get his weekly paycheck, promoter Eddie Quinn asked him if he'd gone to the hospital to see Eric, which was a block away. Kowalski said he hadn't, but Quinn told him it would be a good idea to apologize to him. It was more likely the next day because the story was well known and definitely happened, but on October 17, 1952, Kowalski wrestled Vic Christie in St. Louis. It was likely Quinn setting up an angle and not even letting Kowalski know about it. Quinn told his assistant to make sure Kowalski went to the hospital, but when he got there, by coincidence, there was a reporter from the local newspaper as well as a crew from the biggest television station in the city. Kowalski, still not fully grasping why he was there, saw the reporters and went to leave. The employee then screamed to the reporter, "Kowalski's out there." Kowalski actually never entered the room, looked in the room, and Eric smiled at him. He smiled back, and soon both started laughing. Kowalski always claimed he looked at Eric sitting on the bed with his head all bandaged, and I swear the first thing I thought of was Humpty Dumpty on the wall. Yukon Eric looked at me, shook his head, and smiled, and I started laughing, and he laughed too. The next day, in the local newspaper, there was a big story about how Vladik Kowalski, as he was known in Montreal at the time, went to the hospital to laugh at what he had done to Yukon Eric. Kowalski himself had no idea about all this publicity, as he was already being flown out of town. Or he had already flown out of town. He came back in town 6 days later for a match where he defended his title against Tarzan Zora. Amidst all the publicity during the week about what he did, a reporter called him Killer Kowalski, and the fans yelled, "You're a killer," at him during his match the next week. The name started to stick. When Eric returned from his injuries, he challenged Kowalski for the title in their first match since the incident took place on January 14, 1953 at the Montreal Forum. It was the first wrestling match that aired on national television in Canada. He was billed in the match as Killer Kowalski, a name he used from that point forward. The two worked grudge matches throughout North America over the next year, usually with Eric getting disqualified for going berserk in their first meeting to set up the rematches. But even with the angle, Eric wrestled Kowalski the first year when the feud was the hottest, no more than the big four babyfaces in wrestling at the time who toured North America, Gagne, Thesz, O'Connor, and Watson. By 1957, he was traveling less and seemed to base his operations out of Quebec and upstate New York while still appearing in places like Boston, St. Louis, and Minneapolis for big shows, and eventually Madison Square Garden by the end of the year. By 1958, he moved his base to Philadelphia, working in the New York territory for the first few months of the year before returning to Montreal as his base in the spring. He held the world title in Montreal all year since the Kaniski win at the baseball stadium, and then won the Boston version of the world title from Carpentier. His big rival that year in both circuits was Pat O'Connor, who he faced over and over again in title defenses, with lots of draws and DQs ending, as well as Kowalski's wins throughout the year. His reputation grew from an incident on June 2, 1958. Boston title defense against Pat O'Connor with Jack Dempsey, the boxing legend, as referee. Kowalski accidentally kicked Dempsey in the wrong place when it was a time for a ref bump, and Dempsey was hospitalized that night. Since Dempsey was a sports icon, that got some national attention and served to enhance Kowalski's reputation, since by this point, the knee drop of the ear in so many circles had turned into the legend of his biting off Eric's ear. He remained champion on both circuits, going back and forth, in 1959, including picking up a new major rival in Pepper Gomez. Years before it became one of the most famous angles in wrestling, when Gomez worked with Ray Stevens in San Francisco, Kowalski did the same thing in both Boston and Montreal. The gimmick was that Gomez had a cast-iron stomach and that nothing could hurt him. In every match, the heels would throw haymaker punches, while Gomez, a former high-level competition bodybuilder, would flex his abs and laugh. Even though Gomez was about a foot shorter than Kowalski, the gimmick that he sold as a challenger is that Kowalski's main finisher was the stomach claw, and in television angles, Kowalski would put the claw on Gomez, and it would have no effect. Then Kowalski hit him with a baseball bat in the stomach, and again, Gomez no-sold it. It resulted in a challenge where a ladder would be brought in and wrestlers would jump off the ladder with a knee drop to the stomach, but the wrestlers would jump midway up on the ladder. Finally, in the case of Kowalski, like Stevens, came off the top of the ladder but with a knee drop to the throat, and Gomez started coughing up blood. In Boston, where it aired on WBZ-TV, viewers freaked out so much that the police were called and came down to the studio before being told it was just part of the act. The first match back sold out Boston Gardens well ahead of time. He traded the Montreal title that year with Rogers and had another short New York run in late 1959 and early 1960, but mostly worked Boston, Montreal, and Chicago with main opponents Gomez, Johnny Valentine, Luthez, Big Daddy Lipscomb, Bruno Sammartino, Carpentier, Haystacks Calhoun, Neff Maivia, and Bearcat Wright. In October, he moved his base of operations to working for Jim Barnett in cities like Detroit, Milwaukee, Cincinnati, and Indianapolis. He played off the Gomez angle there as well, and also was put back together with Yukon Eric, and eventually feuded with Dick the Bruiser, the circuit's biggest star. He lost his Boston title to Wright on April 4, 1961 at the Boston Garden. By August, he was splitting time between Barnett's circuit and the Vancouver circuit, and at the end of the year became a regular for Stampede Wrestling. He was billed as world champion for Stampede Wrestling to separate it from the NWA. Stu Hart called him the NAWA World Champion, which, to further confuse the marketplace, was for National American Wrestling Alliance. This stemmed from Rogers beating O'Connor in the famous Comiskey Park match in Chicago for the title. Vince McMahon Sr. was booking Rogers, and aside from a few big money cities like St. Louis, it was becoming more and more difficult for the NWA promoters to get dates on the champion, which led to a lot of dissension. Hart used Kowalski as champion during this period, and he was based in Calgary, while also working dates in the British Columbia, Washington circuit, and occasionally flying out for big city shows. After leaving in the summer of 1962, it was back to mainly working major markets, main events, concentrating on Montreal, Boston, St. Louis, and Chicago, with opponents like Carpentier, Giant Baba, Johnny Valentine, Buddy Rogers, Bruno Sammartino, Gene Kaniski, and Bobo Brazil. It was a schedule he remained on until the spring of 1963, when he began a five-year period where he was rarely in North America. While Kowalski was billed as world champion on and off for 11 years for Quinn, in one of wrestling's top markets, he was also billed as champion for three straight years in the Boston area. He never held the NWA or WWWF title. The WWWF title was the province of babyfaces, and Kowalski had several northeastern runs where he challenged Sammartino during both of Sammartino's title reigns. Kowalski also had several matches with Rogers as NWA champion in the northeast before the WWWF days. He was a consistent top challenger for the NWA title in the 50s and 60s and was briefly billed as champion. On November 21st, 1962, interestingly, just 8 days before champ Buddy Rogers was allegedly scheduled to drop the title to Luthez in Toronto. Luthez told Dave Meltzer it was scheduled for a few days later, although others believe the title change was scheduled for December 14th in Houston. Buddy Rogers defended the NWA title against IWA champion Kowalski in Montreal in a match that was most likely scheduled to end up as a draw. But early in the match, Kowalski drop-kicked Rogers, who took a bump to the floor, and in doing so broke his ankle. Rogers got back in the ring and submitted in the first fall of a 2-of-3-fall match, but couldn't answer the bell for the second fall. Since there was no authorization for a title switch, Kowalski wasn't given the NWA title, even though that ruling made absolutely no sense from a logic standpoint. But with Rogers out for a few weeks, Kowalski took over several of his title defense dates, which he wasn't thrilled at the time as doing. Kowalski said later that he did believe Rogers was really injured, but couldn't say he was sure about it. The NWA was clearly skeptical, since it was the second time they had tried to book Thea's Rogers title change, where Rogers came up with an injury right before the title change. Although nobody questioned the first time it happened, with the incident where Rogers got a broken hand when Bill Miller slammed a door on Buddy Rogers as he tried to escape from a roughing up from Carl Gotch in Columbus, Ohio a few months earlier. He was billed in a few cities during that period as a world champion. He did a heavily publicized Houston date with Lou Thesz on December 14, 1962, with Kowalski billed as the NWA champion, doing a 90-minute draw. He was billed as the NWA title claimant on January 4, 1963 in St. Louis when he took a booking originally scheduled for Rogers versus Johnny Valentine by beating Valentine. 2 weeks later, they had a rematch as a Texas Death Match won by Valentine. It wasn't unusual for Sam Mushnick to do back-to-back features like that, said Larry Madison. But obviously, there were political reasons. Sam loved him. Felt he was honorable, intelligent, and a man of his word, and never a problem. It bothered Sam that he was billed as Walter in most places, and not by what Sam said was his real name, Vladek. Typical Sam, but he loved the name Killer Kowalski. Valentine and Kowalski had already started a program in November in the city, so Valentine was the logical contender if Kowalski would come in. And Kowalski, as the claimant while Rogers was out of action, couldn't lose to Valentine. But Valentine, the bigger star in St. Louis, was the logical guy to put over at the end of the program. In those days, St. Louis wouldn't book a Texas Death Match as a world title match. Rogers had started back on the road before the Texas Death Match on January 18, 1963, but Kowalski still went into the match billed as the world title claimant. When Rogers came back on January 16, 1963, he came to Montreal and they did a title versus title rematch, this time doing the draw as they were supposed to do the first time. Finally, to make things nice and clean, on January 21, 1963, in Madison Square Garden, Buddy Rogers beat Killer Kowalski in 18 minutes, 14 seconds to settle the dispute over who was the rightful NWA champion before 11,968 fans. 3 days later, Thesz finally beat Rogers in the famed Hard Way or Easy Way match in Toronto that, because Vince McMahon Sr. refused to recognize Lou Thesz as champion, was historical in terms of leading to the creation of the World Wide Wrestling Federation. There's a match on YouTube from February 22, 1963, from the Apple Theater in Chicago, where Kowalski, working as a babyface, wrestled Rogers in a 2-of-3-fall match. Both were billed as world title claimants, even though Kowalski had lost his Montreal title a few weeks earlier to Carpentier. Rogers had lost the NWA title to Thesz, but was still being recognized as champion by McMahon Sr. It's an interesting look at two of the top stars of the era, with Rogers having complete command of the audience, while Kowalski did his relentless work, working a body part style. Buddy Rogers won the match and may have been slightly out of it, given how in his post-match interview he was botching up all of his catchphrases. The Haystacks Calhoun story was in March of 1963. Kowalski was brought in for 2 months for his Japanese debut as the top foreign star of the 5th annual World League Tournament, which ended up being a historical tournament because it was the return of Giant Baba after a 20-month tour of the United States, where Baba had been a major star. Baba had several main events with Kowalski that Kowalski had won, but they were heavily publicized in Japan. But Kowalski's role was unique. He was both supposed to beat Baba since they were building the big match on the tour as Ricky Dozan versus Kowalski in the World League Final. But at the same time, he was supposed to make Baba, who Ricky Dozan has chosen as the guy who would eventually replace him as the country's biggest star. The wrestlers in the World League, Kowalski, Calhoun, Pat O'Connor, Fred Atkins, Cowboy Bob Ellis, Sandor Szabo, Gina Morella, the future Gorilla Monsoon, and Frank Townsend all met in Los Angeles at the airport. In those days, planes had to stop in Honolulu to refuel before leaving for Narita Airport. Somewhere between Honolulu and Tokyo, he saw two wrestlers holding a blanket up covering the entranceway. Behind it, Haystacks Calhoun was going to the bathroom. At around 500 pounds, Calhoun was far too big to get into the small airplane bathroom. One version of the story, told by wrestlers for years, although not by Kowalski, is that one of the wrestlers had spiked Calhoun's drink with X-Lax. It smelled so bad that one of the wrestlers holding a blanket dropped it and ran off, and there was Calhoun, nude, standing in a mailbag. The smell was so bad, people were running to the other side of the plane. It got worse during the tour, as the wrestlers were booked in hotels with Japanese toilets, which were ground level, and Calhoun couldn't squat low enough, so he was going to the bathroom on the floor, which stunk up the hotel rooms near Calhoun. Finally, the wrestlers spoke up and demanded he be booked in hotels that had Western toilets. And the first night, Calhoun sat down and crushed the toilet, and the guys had to pick the pieces of the porcelain out of his body. Wrestlers in their bathroom humor. Bob and Kowalski had four matches on the tour. They had a short draw on March 22, 1963, their famous match on March 24, 1963 at Tokyo Sumo Hall. It was a 45-minute draw that aired live on television, generally remembered as Baba's first great match as a headliner and the singles match that made Baba a superstar in Japan. The third, which was the World League match on April 6, 1963 in Bofu, saw Kowalski win 2 of 3 falls, taking the third with a roll-up. The final match on April 11th in Nagasaki saw them split 2 falls and do a double count-out in the third fall. In the final week, Kowalski beat Morella, Calhoun, and Kentaro Oki to put him in the championship match on May 17, 1963 at Tokyo Gym against Ricky Dozan. That had a famous scene before his lone major match with Ricky Dozan. The Destroyer, who they were grooming as Ricky Dozan's next major opponent, came into the ring at the start of the match. Destroyer shook hands with Ricky Dozan, as that was how the Japanese did business in those days. He went to the corner with Kowalski and his second, Fred Atkins, and Kowalski extended his hand and Bauer punched him. It was an impromptu spot as Dick Bauer was going to shake Kowalski's hand, and Kowalski mumbled to him, "Hit my face." "I didn't understand it," said Bauer years later. "When I hit Killer's face, the sold-out Tokyo fans were very surprised." Bauer credited that spot with getting him over so strong to where the later Ricky Dozan versus Destroyer matches was the single most watched pro wrestling match of its time, and perhaps of all time, with something like 60 to 70 million viewers. It is the second highest rated Japanese wrestling match ever, and still one of the highest rated shows in the history of Japanese television, doing a 64 rating. The World League final that followed saw Ricky Dozan win the first fall with a series of chops. Kowalski won the second fall by countout after ramming Ricky Dozan's head into a table. In the third fall, Kowalski missed a knee drop off the rope and submitted to a Boston Crab. He also had two title matches on the tour, teaming with Atkins in an all-Asian tag team title matches against Ricky Dozan and Toyonabori. In both matches, Atkins lost both falls. He worked mostly in Canada upon his return until his first challenging San Martino, who had won the WWF title from Rogers on the same day Kowalski had lost to Ricky Dozan in the World League Finals. San Martino pinned Kowalski in 20 minutes 58 seconds in a one-match Madison Square Garden program on August 23, 1963, before a sellout crowd of 19,712 fans. Kowalski was just there as a place setter to put over San Martino as they built up San Martino versus Rogers for Roosevelt Stadium, which never took place as Rogers retired from wrestling due to health issues. San Martino and Kowalski were regular opponents in arenas, both big and small, in the Northeast for the next year. That run was also notable for the tag team of Killer Kowalski and Gorilla Monsoon. Monsoon was brought to New York as the replacement for Buddy Rogers with the gimmick that manager Wild Red Berry found this 400-pound beast swimming nude in a pond in his native Manchuria. During this period, Monsoon, billed as the Wild Man from Manchuria, did a gimmick where he couldn't speak. They won the U.S. Tag Team titles, the forerunner to today's WWF World Tag Team titles, beating Brute Bernard and Skull Murphy in two straight falls, November 14, 1963, at the Capitol Sports TV tapings in Washington, D.C. They lost the belts on December 28, 1963, at a house show in Teaneck, New Jersey, also in straight falls, to Chris and John Tolos. While the Tolos brothers were also heels, they were baby faces in this match. As in the localized interviews for the show, they talked about how they have a lot of fans in Teaneck and look forward to the support. The Tolos brothers were greeted as total faces, remembered Mike Omansky. First fall, the ref actually counted a pin with all three men piled on top of Monsoon. Monsoon protested, left the arena, leaving Kowalski alone to face the brothers in a second fall. Kowalski was ultimately pinned. The two continued as a team after the match. Walter Kowalski was the one who came into my life for a brief but so important moment in the early 60s. When I went as a young up-and-coming wrestling star, I went to the New York territory of Vince McMahon Sr. on the recommendation to them by Wild Red Berry in about 63 or 64, said Bill Watts. They booked me with him in Washington, D.C., and there, Vince and all the bosses, including Toots Mont, Phil Zacco, and Willie Gilsenberg, were always there, he said. We did a TV there that hit New York a week later. So I was a featured match, not the main event, that was Bruno, or the semi or co-feature in Washington, D.C., would be Bobo Brazil with his current top opponent, with Kowalski, and they had us go Broadway for 20 minutes, said Watts. And it turned into an awesome match. The people never sat down. It was nonstop, and so the bosses loved it. In fact, Cowboy Bill Watts got over there because that match with Killer and because of going 20 minutes Broadway with him. That's how over he was. Bill Watts noted that Kowalski took a liking to him, and the two traveled together in Kowalski's Cadillac. Plus, he had an airplane, a Beechcraft V-tail Bonanza, then the Cadillac of single-engine planes. He would take me with him in that and also began teaching me to fly it. In fact, once when we went home for a vacation and left me his car keys, which he had his plane keys on it also, I borrowed the plane and flew up and over New York City while the World's Fair was in progress. But he just laughed when I told him. As I said, if you were Walter's friend, you were his friend. He said he and Kowalski at a spot show in Pennsylvania once pulled a rib on the boys by working a shoot. By the time we got to the dressing room, it was set for us to really get them. And in fact, the dressing room chose sides, as the older wrestlers sympathized with Walter, saying, these young guys think they're stars and don't give us who are stars enough respect. And then the younger guys were on my side when I said these older guys don't know when it's downhill time for them. Walter and I had several back-to-back encounters in that dressing room that had to be broken up. It was truly hilarious. And he stormed out of there, and then I stormed out of there. But we were riding home together and laughed the whole way. It was in October of 1964 that Jim Barnett opened up World Championship Wrestling in Australia with Kowalski as the first world champion and top heel, getting the equivalent of a network time slot and running weekly shows in the major cities in that country. It immediately became the hot spot for pro wrestling in the world. The wrestlers lived in 4 or 5 star hotels, flew from coast to coast, and were treated as major celebrities and were paid better than anywhere else at the time. To understand the significance of this and where Kowalski stood in wrestling at the time, in a business that probably three dozen or so full-time territories, each with its own set of main event heels, Barnett was offering more money, more exposure, and better amenities and lifestyle than could be had anywhere in pro wrestling at that point in time. He could have picked any top heel at the time to build around, with the exception of probably the Sheik and Dick the Bruiser, who owned their own territories and couldn't go on a long tour, and Fritz Von Erich, who didn't want to travel with three young sons. He picked Kowalski. For the first 4 years of the promotion, Kowalski, who went back and forth from Australia during that period, was the top heel. Perhaps even more importantly, he was the go-to guy whenever Barnett wanted to make a new top babyface. The three men generally considered to be the biggest stars in the history of the Australian wrestling territory, Dominic DiNucci, Spiros Arion, and Mario Milano, were all made when they beat Kowalski for the world title. Besides those three, he had major singles feuds over the next several years with Bruno Sammartino, Tex McKenzie, Gomez, Billy White Wolf, O'Connor, Eric Frolich, Toro Tanaka, Mark Lewin, Hercules Cortez, Flying Fred Curry, Cowboy Bob Ellis, Bearcat Wright, and many others. While this can't be proven since records don't exist, he most likely headlined more shows and drew more fans as a heel than anyone during what was the golden age of wrestling in that country. His first role was to make DiNucci into the promotion's top star by dropping the title to him on November 7, 1964 in Melbourne. He ended up staying for 11 months. Early on, Kowalski was doing a squash match on television and left the ring, where an old man was shaking his cane at him. Kowalski, thinking the man was part of Barnett's entourage, grabbed the cane and broke it in half. Barnett was furious, and Kowalski felt so bad that not only did he get the man tickets to the upcoming shows, but replaced the cane with one made of silver. Perhaps the most famous thing culturally came a few years later with his May 1967 appearance on the Don Lane Show, which was the country's, which was that country's counterpart to Johnny Carson or Jay Leno, but much bigger. Barnett somehow was able to get Lane to work an angle to put Kowalski over. The angle started with Lane insisting Kowalski put the stomach claw, his finisher, on him. Lane sold it big as Kowalski played the role of a guy there to have fun on a talk show who put the move on and suddenly lost it. The staff had to pull the crazed Kowalski off of Lane, who was carried out on a stretcher, and they had a substitute host finish the show. It was so big, the story got front page headlines in the newspaper the next day, with the Daily Mirror covering it, reading, "Killer Mauls Lane." This led to Kowalski beating White Wolf for the title and having his longest run as champion. He got a television commercial endorsement for Sutton Motors in Sydney. In the commercial, Kowalski noted that he breaks arms for a living, but said that he hadn't had much work lately because the deals at Sutton Motors were so good that nobody needed their arm twisted. Even though the commercial was hilarious, it didn't negatively affect his heel heat. That was part of the unique reaction he got in the country. He was the top heel, but because he seemed to love the country, he was always nice and polite to fans outside the ring. And his religious beliefs and vegetarian habits were well known because he was there for so long. People booed him, but deep down liked him. While his death did not get the media attention in Australia a lot of people would have expected, largely because his heyday was 40 years ago, he was pretty close to a household name in the country during the 1960s from the Don Lane show and TV commercials, as it was a name known even if you weren't a wrestling fan. He did an offshoot of the Gomez angle. This time, they did a television challenge where Gomez allowed Kowalski to put the claw on his cast-iron stomach. The challenge was a certain time limit. Kowalski had to make Gomez submit. When it was clear Gomez wasn't going to submit, Kowalski released the claw and attacked him, ending with a knee to the throat from the top rope. 3 years later, he did the exact same angle with Reggie Parks, another bodybuilder-type wrestler with muscular abs. He left Australia for Hawaii in September 1965 and stayed until January of 1966. The trip was essentially a vacation to give him a break from Australia to freshen him up for a return. Nick Bockwinkle put the Hawaiian circuit in the 1960s its best prospectively when he said that it was the best time of his life, even though the money was nothing special. He noted that people would save up money all year to get a week or two vacation in Hawaii in those days. But that, for the wrestlers who work the circuit, they get a beachfront apartment, spend all day on the beach, work a few nights on the weekend, either short drives or short flights to the neighboring islands. They spent several months there, and when they had left, they had broken even. A headliner like Kowalski could have even come out ahead. Kowalski had lost the title, Spiros Arion, about a month before his run was over, and then put Arion over in all the cities on the way out. When he returned in early 1966, it was announced in Australia that he had beaten Arion in Honolulu in December of 1965. In actuality, no match had taken place, but Kowalski's return as champion was because Arion had jumped to a rival promotion headed by George Garnier. When he came back, they copied the original formula, with him coming in as champion and losing it again to DiNucci, who they decided to go with to replace Arion as the top babyface. In April of 1966, Barnett brought Sammartino in for a three-week tour as the WWWF champion, and he worked there many times with Kowalski. I saw him backstage getting ready, and his right knee was twice the size of his left knee, Sammartino said. He refused to see a doctor or get it drained. He kept on going. We did our match, and I stayed off the knee. He never complained. He never took a pain pill. He just took the pain. He was never a complainer, said Sammartino. Kowalski, for his part, whether exaggerated or not, claimed he only missed three bookings due to injuries in his entire career. Right before he was scheduled to leave, they put him in a heel-versus-heel feud with Tanaka, who held the title, with the idea of Kowalski putting him over, solidifying Tanaka as the new top dog among the heels. Kowalski left Australia in July and spent 9 months working mostly AWA, taking out dates in St. Louis and Montreal, working numerous matches with Gagne, Jack Lanza, and Mad Dog Vachon. He returned to Australia in May of 1967, winning the world title twice as the tag team titles on a tour that lasted until November. He stayed in Hawaii until April of 1968, at which point he went back to Japan for the 10th World League Tournament. By this time, Ricky Dozan had long since passed away, and Toyona Bori was no longer with the group. It was a new era for Japanese wrestling, and two different networks airing the shows in prime time on both Friday and Saturday night in prime time, and the top stars being Baba, Antonio Inoki, and Kim Il, also called Kentaro Oki. It was on this tour that Kowalski always told a story about knocking out Inoki and having then to lose to him in Osaka, but in fact, that didn't happen. Inoki and Kowalski had two matches, a best-of-three-fall match on April 20th, 1968 in Fukushima that went to a 45-minute draw after each man won a fall, and a World League tournament match on May 7th, 1968 in Kumamoto, which was a 30-minute draw. The two shows on the tour in Osaka saw him beat Mitsu Hirai, the father of All-Japan wrestler Nobukazu Hirai, and lose to Baba. Kowalski's story was that Inoki knocked him out with a back suplex, but that he recovered just before being pinned. Kowalski said when he got up, he was furious and punched Inoki as hard as he could and knocked him out cold. He said he realized Inoki had to win, so he had to struggle with his dead weight to pick him up, then fell backwards with Inoki on top and had the ref count three. He left the ring, and Inoki, still unconscious, got his hand raised. However, that would have never happened since the way wrestling was booked in those days. Kowalski wasn't going to lose to anyone on that tour until the climatic match with Baba. In fact, Inoki never beat Kowalski, which was more because by the time Inoki became the level of star who would have, and Kowalski was no longer the protected foreigner on every tour, Inoki had left to form New Japan Wrestling. In that tournament, which included such names as Baba, Kowalski, Inoki, Il, Fred Blassie, DiNucci, Tarzan Tyler, Jess Ortega, and Angelo Poffa, Lynn Rossi, Pat Patterson, Duke Kiyomoka, and Mishikai Yoshimura. The two big stars were Baba and Kowalski, stemming from their matches 5 years earlier. Baba and Kowalski first had a 30-minute draw on April 6, 1968 at Sumo Hall, and in the tournament finals on May 17th in Osaka, Baba scored his first win ever over Kowalski. He went back to Australia after this tour, winning the tag team titles with Bill Miller. He finally returned to the Northeast after Thanksgiving in 1968 for a 1969 run of matches with San Martino. He and Monsoon often teamed, claiming that they were U.S. Tag Team Champions. The belts had been dropped in 1967 and weren't replaced by the international tag team titles until the summer of 1969. Kowalski and Monsoon weren't officially recognized as Tag Team Champions, even though the promotion at that time had no Tag Team Champions, but claimed themselves as the rightful champions, saying they had never truly lost the title years earlier. At the time, the two top babyfaces were Bruno Sammartino and Victor Rivera. In Kowalski's return to Madison Square Garden on January 27, 1969, after Monsoon and Rivera traded falls, Kowalski scored a rare pin on Sammartino in the third fall before 11,569 fans. This was during a low period for Madison Square Garden. The wrestling there had no local television, and they were promoting the shows based off of newspaper ads. Sammartino and Kowalski did a double disqualification on February 17, 1969, before 9,639 fans. Sammartino won the rematch by countout March 7, 1969, before 11,326 fans, and the feud ended in a tag team match on May 14, 1969, when Bruno Sammartino and Victor Rivera beat Killer Kowalski and Toru Tanaka before 7,670 fans. However, the feud was huge in Boston. After two sellouts at the Boston Gardens, the blow-off match, a stretcher match on June 28, 1969, was moved to Fenway Park. A memorable match from that run was March 9, 1970 at Madison Square Garden. By this point, Waldo Von Erich was an even more hated heel, and they did a rare battle of the top heels after the two had broken up on the prior show, losing to international tag team champions Rivera and Tony Marino. The fans were going crazy cheering for Kowalski, but they had a double DQ finish as they fought over Von Erich's riding crop that killed the crowd. An interesting twist is the main event on that show was Sammartino versus Crippler Carl Kovacs. Kovacs was the ring name for Midwest veteran star Stan the Big K Kowalski, a former University of Minnesota football player named Burt Smith, who started using the Kowalski name in 1950 and was often confused with Killer when he used the name Crusher Kowalski. That included an incident in the early 1970s when there was a national news story about NFL star Russ Francis, who was working in the AWA during the offseason, beating Killer Kowalski. Kowalski was furious and forced a retraction, as Francis had been referring to Stan Kowalski instead. Living in Philadelphia again, he worked the territory exclusively until March of 1970 and was no longer the globe-trotting star he had been. His next run was in Texas, starting in April, which was doing big business with stars like Fritz Von Erich, Gomez, Wahoo McDaniel, Johnny Valentine, Emil Mascaras, and Thunderbolt Patterson as headliners. Since Valentine was a tweener and the rest were babyfaces, Kowalski was a welcome addition, although Paul Bosch noted that Kowalski was not nearly the draw they expected him to be, and blamed that on him having lost so much muscle mass since the early 1960s and looking much older, as he was in his early 40s by this point. It was during this period that he drew the last big house in St. Louis. Kowalski no longer had his plane and wasn't much for the traveling all over North America with the kind of schedule of working main events in so many major markets that only a few top attractions could do. His name was still one of the strongest in wrestling, but he was years past what was his box office peak. Still, he was brought in for a television taping and worked an angle out of a tag team match with his old rival, Pat O'Connor. in what was likely their last meeting, with Nothing Strong underneath, a Texas death match won by O'Connor, drew a near sellout of 10,580 fans to the Kiel Auditorium. He gave his notice in February and lost his brass knucks title to Valentine and then dropped a loser leaves town match to Thunderbolt Patterson on February 16, 1971 in Dallas and went back to Australia for his final tour. When he arrived, it was as the tag team partner of Mark Lewin, one of Australia's all-time most popular wrestlers. Kowalski claimed he had changed his ways and he and Lewin started a feud with young heels, the Texas Outlaws, Dick Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes. As Murdoch and Rhodes were leaving the country, Kowalski and Lewin beat them for the IWA tag team titles. Kowalski wrestled a completely different style, revolving around arm drags and drop kicks. The matches would see the heels continue to cheat on Kowalski, who would blow his cool and revert to back to being the old Kowalski, while Lewin would have to calm him down. In April, Kowalski finally turned on Lewin in a televised match, leading to Kowalski and Bulldog Bob Brown feuding with Lewin and Curtis Iaquea. The Lewin and Iaquea babyface team, featuring more blood than had ever been seen in the territory, led to one of the best drawing periods ever in Australia. But like in so many areas, that run is blamed for the downfall of the promotion, as once the fan were used to seeing bloodbath matches, crowds started to dwindle, and shortly after the peak, Barnett sold out and returned to the United States after acquiring the Georgia Territory. Kowalski had singles programs with Lewin and Iaquea before leaving Australia for what turned out to be the last time in September of 1971. His next stop was Japan for the 1971 NWA Tag League Tournament. His team was known as the Killers, with Killer Buddy Austin, who had been a headliner in Japan on several tours in the 1960s. The two lost in the finals to Baba and Sigi Sakaguchi on November 1, 1971 at the Tokyo City Gym. His key matches were two double countouts with Inoki and one with Baba, as well as a 2-out-of-3 fall match with Baba on November 9, 1971 in Okinawa. He returned home to work for the Sheik in Detroit after the tour for a couple months with the Sheik as top heel. Kowalski worked as a big name in the mid-card in Detroit and Toronto, but the only way you headlined in those cities at the time was going face, and that didn't happen. Next came a relatively short but well-remembered run in Southern California, which was his first time in as a regular in that state since his 1951 feud with Don Leo Jonathan in Northern California. Leo Nomolini in Northern California. By this point, with his hair having thinned, Kowalski started wrestling with a toupee and started developing the trademark bump, where he'd both take the bump and grab his hair to make sure it didn't come loose. That probably led to the idea of wrestling with a mask a few years later on. He arrived in Los Angeles as an instant headliner. They announced that he had beaten Cowboy Frankie Lane to win the America's title, the area's top singles belt, in Tampa. He arrived with the belt to brutalize Don Savage in a Wednesday night television match. The Wednesday night tapings at the Olympic Auditorium were important because they were syndicated nationally on the Spanish International Network. To make him stronger, he defeated Lane in two straight falls in his first major Friday night main event at the Olympic, and he was selling nothing in his televised matches, which was unusual for that circuit, where the TV bouts, even though they were often star versus jobber, still had a measure of back-and-forth action. Rocky Johnson, who had been a major headliner a couple years earlier, was brought back, and Kowalski destroyed him. Next was Fred Blassie, the area's all-time most popular wrestler, in a live Saturday night television match on KCOP television, which ran a 90-minute show in those days that drew big ratings. Kowalski delivered a knee drop off the top rope onto his knee, and it was announced that Blassie was injured and would need surgery. It was an attempt to reprise the hugely successful angle from the previous year, where John Tolos, in the same studio, took Blassie with the Monsul powder. Like the year before, it was a cover reason for Blassie to have knee surgery. Even Sam Martino, in between runs as WWF champion, was brought to Los Angeles, and they did a DQ finish, but Sam Martino left Kowalski with heat. But even with this monster push, Kowalski's style didn't get over in Southern California and wasn't drawing well. The crowd was heavily Mexican-American by that point, and Kowalski's style didn't mesh well with the Lucha Libre background of so many of the baby faces. His facials and selling were almost comical because of the style clash. He was put in a program with Tolos with the storyline, believe it or not, that Tolos was now a babyface looking to gain revenge for what Kowalski did to his good friend Blassie. But it didn't click. Tolos won the title barely 6 weeks after Kowalski had arrived for what was certainly appeared to be, at the time, a major heel run. Kowalski did stick around, working lower on the card, even winning the tag team title with Kenji Shibuya, waiting for the final revenge match with Blassie. There was no time for a long run, as Blassie was getting back just before Kowalski was the next scheduled to return to Japan. Kowalski put Blassie over on June 16, 1972, at the Olympic Auditorium, worked another week in the territory, and headed back to Japan. Lesser known is that he also went to Southern California to help start the career of a protege who started out with one of the worst heel ring names you could have. The Mighty Minton. John Minton, the 6'7" prelim wrestler, would later become his tag team partner as the other half of the Masked Executioners in his last major league run, and after that would go on his own with the name that stuck, Big John Studd. His final tour with the old JWA promotion was a quick 2-week tour. The big match was Baba and Sakaguchi defending the international tag team titles against Kowalski and Moose Cholak, ending with Sakaguchi getting the third fall win over Kowalski with a Boston Crab. In another big match on the tour, he once again put over Baba in a singles match. This was just before Baba quit the promotion, got the blessing of NTV, and formed All Japan Pro Wrestling. His next stop was Montreal, which was in the middle of North America's biggest promotional war. Eddie Quinn had closed his promotion in 1964 due to poor health, and in 1965, as Johnny Rougeau and Bob Legs Levine started running. In 1971, Paul Vachon, Gary Lanault, and Lucien Gregoire started Grand Prix Wrestling. In opposition, pulling some of the cities, legendary stars like the Vachon brothers, Carpentier, Don Leo Jonathan, Joe and Paul LeDuc, and Jean Ferry, Andre the Giant, of course. Rougeau built around himself and brother Jacques Rougeau Sr. as the top stars, along with Johnny Valentine, the Sheik, Abdullah the Butcher, and Ivan Koloff as their rivals. Kowalski mainly worked Montreal, taking out dates in Pittsburgh, where his renewed rivalry with San Martino, who at this point was between title runs. San Martino and Kowalski also crossed paths in Montreal at this point in a tag team match with San Martino and Eduardo Carpentier, winning the Grand Prix tag team titles from Dale Roberts, the future Buddy Roberts, and Jerry Brown, managed by Sir Oliver Humperdinck, who they were not yet known as the Hollywood Blondes. Kowalski and Gilles Poisson started a program and got the belts when San Martino missed a show, and it was a handicap match win over Carpentier. Both groups did big business as each brought in top stars from around North America for the war. In many ways, the early 1970s battle in Montreal served as a microcosm for what happened in the United States some 25 years later with the Monday Night War, and proved to foretell what would happen. At first, business for both sides was huge, and the city was on fire. The Kowalski versus Carpentier feud that started in the 1950s was still packing them in as they battled over the Grand Prix World Championship. It was as champion when Kowalski scored at least one pinfall win over Ferrey. The Rougeau slide during that period sold out Jarry Park, the local baseball stadium, with 26,000 fans for the Sheik versus Johnny Rougeau, while the Grand Prix side set the Canadian all-time indoor attendance and gate record, building up Ferre's first major grudge, although interestingly, they picked more powerful-looking Don Leo Jonathan instead of Kowalski as the opponent in the Battle of the Giants. Kowalski finished in Montreal for the last time as a star in a major promotion just before Grand Prix went down. Like with the Monday Night War, when the surviving Rougeaus did early interpromotional matches, fans were dreaming of seeing sellout business after winning the war, but it was short-lived. The city's entire wrestling economy would end up collapsing in 1975, and both sides were out of business, leaving no Major League Wrestling in Kowalski's best city over the last few years of his career. Kowalski debuted for Baba's All Japan Pro Wrestling in late 1973 on a loaded tour as he was the number three foreigner behind San Martino and Fritz Von Erich. The gimmick was San Martino and Kowalski, the legendary Madison Square Garden rivals, would form a tag team in the main event on several of the big shows. San Martino said he never fully understood it. He asked Baba if he should work his heel, and Baba said he wanted him to be Strong Bruno, but wanted Kowalski to be the character he had already played. The two teamed up, each doing their thing, but not teasing hatred, their past feud, or breakup. Kowalski's always losing the key falls, as they did 2 out of 3 fall matches to Baba and Jumbo Tsuruta 3 times, and 2 straight fall losses to Baba and Anton Giesink, who was a 6'6", 300-pound 1964 judo gold medalist who debuted on that tour and who they gave a super push to as a pro wrestler, but ultimately Giesink was a flop. Killer Kowalski and Fritz Von Erich also lost to Baba and Thunder Sugiyama and Baba and the Destroyer, with Kowalski again being the one to beat Kim Il on the opening night of the tour and to go to draws with Tsuruta, Destroyer, and Giesink. With San Martino back as WWF champion after beating Stan Stasiak on December 10, 1973 in Madison Square Garden, 9 days after Stasiak beat Pedro Morales, by the spring of 1974, he went for his final run as a singles headliner in the promotion. San Martino and Kowalski went to a double countout on April 29, 1974 in Madison Square Garden. This led to a Texas Death Match, which drew 17,103 fans. The San Martino that San Martino won on May 20th, 1974. He and San Martino worked a 2 or 3 match program in every major city, along with a few minor ones. Although San Martino's deal to come back as champion came under his terms of an easier schedule, the program ended up lasting almost until the end of the year in the last major run between the two rivals. Kowalski also teamed some with Bobby Duncan, and also worked Toronto as a babyface to build up for 2 matches with the Sheik. Kowalski hadn't been in St. Louis since the O'Connor match in 1970. Business in the city was strong at the time, but they had a show on January 17, 1975 that didn't have the stars available. Kowalski came back for 1 last show as a favor to Mushnick to bail out a bad card, put in the main event challenging Dory Funk Jr. for the Missouri state title. It was a disappointment, as Mushnick thought the fans would respond to the return of Kowalski, who had been a major draw in the city since 1950 and drew a near sellout the last time in. But too much time had passed, and Kowalski did no local television to build up the match, which drew only 4,750 fans. His last major tour of Japan was right back where he started. The World League had become the Champions Carnival, and in 1975, Baba and Kowalski were still two of the big names in the tournament. Kowalski beat the undercard names, drew twice with the Destroyer, drew and lost to Tsuruta, and went to a double countout and draw with Baba, but he failed to make the finals, the final four, consisting of Baba, Destroyer, Gene Kaniski, and Mr. Wrestling Tim Woods. He had 2 title matches, both for the international tag team titles on the tour. On April 19, 1975, in Kuriyama, Baba and Tsuruta beat Gene Kaniski and Kowalski when Tsuruta surprisingly pinned Kaniski in the third fall. The surprise is because Baba versus Kaniski on May 3rd was the Champion Carnival final. But it was important not to beat Kowalski in the third fall. The next, and Kowalski's last major match in Japan, was May 6 in Gifu, where Giant Baba and Tsuruta kept the titles, beating San Martino and Kowalski, as Baba and San Martino split falls and Tsuruta pinned Kowalski in just under 30 minutes. It was during this period that Eddie Einhorn and Pedro Martinez formed the International Wrestling Alliance with the goal of promoting wrestling on a national basis and competing with the WWWF and NWA in the biggest markets. Kowalski had claimed that he was offered $2,000 a week to come in and headline against Mil Máscaras, whom the promotion built around as its world champion. It was gigantic money for a wrestler in those days, but Kowalski refused out of loyalty to the established promoters. It turned out to be a good thing since that promotion didn't last. Kowalski remained out of North America until late in the year. He showed up in Florida as the Mass Destroyer, taking the famous name of the man who he told to punch him a dozen years earlier in Japan. He was immediately given the Southern Championship. Kowalski likely donned the mask because he was looking older and also because under a mask he didn't have to worry about his hair. It was no secret who he was among ringsiders at the time, but unlike Executioner Number 1, where every fan knew it was Kowalski, he had not wrestled much in Florida many years, and a casual television audience would not have known. His big rival at the time was Billy Robinson, who won the Southern title from him and then beat him in a title versus mask match while in Florida. Kowalski met Frank the Hammer Goodish, at that point a 320-pound power lifter and ex-football player, and recommended him to Vince McMahon Sr. as an opponent for San Martino. McMahon renamed him Bruiser Frank Brody. Before starting what turned out to be his last major WWWF run, Kowalski went back to try and help revitalize Toronto. Burned out by the Sheik and not drawing, he beat Dominic Nucci twice to set up a title match with San Martino. But that city still struggled at the gate until being built around Ric Flair a few years later. In April of 1976, Kowalski and Minton showed up as the Masked Executioners. In those days, just as the WWWF title was on a babyface long term, McMahon Sr.'s tag teams had their own pattern. Every 9 months or so, a new heel team would be brought in to win the titles, usually on television, have their run, lose, and then depart a few months later. Usually the identity of a masked man is supposed to be a secret. But Kowalski's voice and ring style were unmistakable. Everyone knew Kowalski was Executioner 1, and in truth, the promotion wanted everybody to know because it gave the team more credibility than most of the heel tag team champions. A lot of fans knew Chuck O'Connor as Minton was best known at the time, likely taking his name from television actor Chuck Connors, was the other executioner simply because there were a few guys in wrestling even bigger than Kowalski. They quickly won the WWWF tag team titles from Tony Parisi and Louis Sirdin, that was the name of Gino Brito at the time, on May 11, 1976 at the TV tapings in Philadelphia. He did work a few title matches with San Martino, one-time deals where he lost in Philadelphia, Comic and Long Island, and perhaps other places. And most likely, their last singles match was at the new Capitol Center in Landover, Maryland. The Executioners kept the tag titles, losing by DQ to Chief J. Strongbow and Billy White Wolf at the June 25, 1976 Shea Stadium show that was closed-circuited throughout the Northeast, since it was the Northeast feed underneath the Muhammad Ali versus Antonio Inoki show. Instead of losing the title to Strongbow and White Wolf, as was expected, in an October 26 match at the TV tapings in Hamburg, PA, a third executioner did a switch. That was Nikolai Volkoff under a mask, and the titles were stripped, which led to a tournament where the Iraqi and Italian native playing Native Americans ended up as champions. Usually that meant the team was on its way out, but the Executioners remained full-time until finishing up on April 23, 1977 in Providence, where they lost a tag match to Andre the Giant and Carlos Rocha. After what seemed like a lifetime of being consistently one of the biggest names in the industry and never falling below main event level, and within driving distance of his hometown, there was no ceremony in the ring. There was nothing special behind the scenes in the dressing room that night. He came in as a loner, spent about 30 years on the road as one, and then drove back to his apartment in Boston that night. Kowalski always would mention a quiet night in Providence with no fanfare as the end of his career. although he described the circumstances differently, saying he beat some little shelp who was half his size, as opposed to actually working with Andre in a semifinal to the WWF title in a major arena. But he worked plenty of matches after that point on independent shows, usually main events on shows he promoted, for another 15 or so years. But he had only a couple of major league matches after that. He had at least one in 1979, a small town match on a WWF circuit with Monsoon. He did a 1987 WWF Legends Battle Royal at the Meadowlands. And his final match on a big stage was September 19th, 1992, when FMW brought him in for a Legends match at Yokohama Baseball Stadium. And before 30,000 fans, he went to a 10-minute draw with Tolos underneath and at Sushi Onita versus Tiger Jeet Singh bloodbath. The wrestling career of that Killer Kowalski was over in 1977, but the Killer Kowalski School of Wrestling at that point was just getting ready to open for business. That should say, I guess, 1997. I'm not sure. Our third and final installment of The Life of Killer Kowalski will most likely run next week, and to my knowledge, it never ran. So as that's all I could find there, unless I just missed an issue. So I know that was long. It was quite a bit. There was it was very hastily edited, it looked like, with lots and lots of typographical errors I had to work my way around. But hopefully you now know more about the life and times and career of Killer Kowalski than you did, as I continue to work to put together the Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling Zone over at whenitwascool.com. Lots and lots of Kowalski information over there, and certainly when I come out with my greatest wrestlers of all time list in the not-too-distant future, you will see Kowalski on there again, and we'll be sure to talk about him again when that comes out. So thank you very much for listening. Visit us over at whenitwascool.com. We're working on several major pro wrestling history projects over there that you can be a part of. You can see. Hope you will become a Patreon supporter. And we will see you here again soon with another show.
We depend on Patreon support for our website and podcast network. In order to continue these podcasts you enjoy, we need you to visit whenitwascool.com and pledge at least $1. You'll gain access to lots of exclusive podcasts, newsletters, and more. Sign up is quick, simple, and can be canceled at any time. WhenItWasCool.com and click any Patreon link. Thank you.